The rivalry between the United States and China is potentially the most important geopolitical issue facing American policymakers today. Professor Graham Allison, director of the Belfer Center of Science and International Affairs at Harvard University, points out that over the past 500 years, 12 of 16 geopolitical confrontations between an existing great power and its fast-growing rival have ended in war, including Germany and Britain, who collided in the First World War in spite of their large commercial relationship. When war was avoided, Professor Allison concludes, it required huge, painful adjustments in attitudes and actions on the part of both the challenger and the challenged. Geopolitical power is driven by national wealth. So will the United States, recently dethroned as the world's biggest economy by China, have to shed its stated objective to be the world's primary power and share that stage with China, at least in Southeast Asia? Or is permanent leadership of every region of the world so hardwired into the American DNA that it would rather fight than switch? In this virtual roundtable of six podcasts, the Foreign Policy Association aims to shed some light and serve as a catalyst for developing awareness, understanding, and informed opinion on the key issues that face American policymakers as they seek to peer over the horizon to manage the U.S.-China relationship. In the first two podcasts, we try to gauge the temperature of the existing state of U.S.-China relations through the eyes of Professor Kishore Mahbubani, Dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy in Singapore, and Mr. Nisad Hajjari, also based in Singapore, who oversees Asia coverage for Bloomberg View, the editorial board of Bloomberg News. The next two podcasts deal with the national security and foreign policy dimensions of the relationship through conversations with Professor Toshi Yoshihara, the John A. Van Buren Chair of Asia-Pacific Studies at the United States Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and Bonnie Glazer, Senior Advisor for Asia and Director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. The final two podcasts explore the trade and economic dimensions with Stephen Roach, Senior Fellow at Yale University's Jackson Institute of Global Affairs and a Senior Lecturer at Yale School of Management, and Mark Chandler, Chief Currency Strategist for Brown Brothers Harriman, the Wall Street Investment Bank. And with that background, let me introduce our interlocutor for the first podcast. Kishore Mahbubani is the Dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy in Singapore. Before that, he served in the Singapore Foreign Service for 33 years, notably as Ambassador to the United Nations and twice as President of the United Nations Security Council. He was Permanent Secretary at the Foreign Ministry from 1993 to 1998. Professor Mahbubani has authored five books, including The Great Convergence, selected by the Financial Times as one of the best books of 2013. Here's my conversation with Dean Mahbubani, who speaks to me from his offices in Singapore. So, Ambassador Mahbubani, how would you describe the state of relations between China and the U.S. today?
I would say there's a very high degree of wariness on both sides. Fortunately, things are not as bad as they should be. Because normally, when a new great power emerges, like China, and when it is on the verge of becoming the number one power, there should actually be rising level of suspicion and certainly possibility of tension and conflict between the two great powers.
Right.
So what you're seeing now is something that's very abnormal, because while they are obviously wary of each other, there's no effort by the United States to contain China, and indeed, on the positive side of the ledger, they are still cooperating a great deal in many areas.
So there's a lot of talk here amongst think tank people about the so-called Thucydides trap, where when an emerging power, you know, comes into confrontation with a established de facto power, that there is always this tenseness. But you seem to, from your perch in Singapore, feel that that is not really as bad as it could be.
Yeah, it's not as bad as it could be. But you see, the other piece of intellectual dishonesty I find among American public intellectuals is that when they talk about a Thucydides trap, of course, the assumption is that the United States is the responsible power and China is the irresponsible power. And frankly, I have yet to meet a virtuous great power. All great powers project their own self-interest. And it's a mistake to think that either United States or China are necessarily more virtuous than the other.
But isn't that something that all countries do, Ambassador Mahbubani, that they keep their self-interest before anyone else's?
Yes, but you know, it is at the same time rather hypocritical for United States to call on China to respect international law when United States itself doesn't respect international law. When I was president of the UN Security Council, the Security Council received a request from the president of the World Court, ICJ, to come and just give a speech to the UN Security Council. All the other 14 members of the Security Council agreed. Only one Security Council member objected vehemently, and that was the United States of America, who refused to have a dialogue with the World Court. So the United States' track record in undermining international judicial institutions is actually far worse than China.
It's an interesting point that you make, but let me ask you, does this also carry over into the fact that the United States is not signed on to the United Nations Law of the Sea Treaty? Do you think that this has an impact on how people in your part of the world view America?
Well, I mean, I can tell you that, you know, in my latest book, The Great Convergence, I actually argue that it is in America's national interest today to try and ratify international laws, treaties, and support multilateral institutions. And I begin the book by quoting from a speech that Bill Clinton gave in Yale in 2003, where he said that surely it is now in America's national interest to prepare for becoming number two by strengthening multilateral rules and processes.
Right.
So what I'm actually arguing for is for America to do something that is in its own national interest, you know, to support international law. But the problem in Washington, D.C. is that it's very difficult in Washington, D.C. to get any kind of new thinking because everybody's thinking has become fossilized on the international order.
Right.
And since the United States has consistently undermined international law, it continues to do so.
So without getting more deeply into that point, I wanted to ask you that the appearance here, headlines tell us that China is more or less in the same position because it argues that it owns almost all of the South China Sea with the Nine Dash Line. So do you think that both countries, not following the kinds of multilateral institutions that you've just described, that this is just a natural occurrence that happens when two of the biggest powers confront each other or are competing with one another?
Well, I actually think that, unfortunately, China is following the bad example of United States in this area.
Ah.
So United States refuses to respect international court, and China refuses to respect international court. But in terms of the actual claims that China is making on the South China Sea, the good news is that there is a lot of strategic ambiguity in the Chinese claim.
Okay.
Now, it is true that the Chinese have drawn a nine-dash line that covers all of South China Sea. However, they've been very vague on what is the meaning of the nine-dash line, and they continue to claim that all countries can have freedom of navigation through the South China Sea. Now, if you allow freedom of navigation through the South China Sea, it means that they are not territorial waters of China.
So there is a space there for diplomats to engage.
That's right.
Okay.
There's a lot of space there, because what the Chinese are firm on is their claims over some of the islands and rocks in the South China Sea. But what exactly they mean by the nine dash line, that's not spelled out.
Okay.
And actually, it's good that they haven't spelled it out.
Yes.
Because if they spell it out, it'll be trouble.
We take it for granted in the United States that since the Second World War, the United States has been the power that has maintained freedom of navigation and so on, and that we are a Pacific power, and that we continue to have primacy to ensure that freedom of navigation exists as it always has. Is that the way that the smaller countries in Southeast Asia also view the state of affairs in your part of the world?
Well, I mean, certainly the American military presence is appreciated in this region. I can tell you that South Korea, Japan, and virtually all the ASEAN countries welcome the U.S. naval presence in the region, because you're right, it helps to keep international sea lanes safe and good for international commerce. And by the way, by keeping international sea lanes safe, the biggest beneficiary of this, of course, is China, since China is the biggest trader in the world today. So the U.S. Navy is doing China a big favor by keeping international sea lanes free and safe.
Right.
But at the same time, of course, a lot depends on how the U.S. Navy behaves. If the U.S. Navy, for example, does things that are provocative, then, of course, there will be some disquiet in the region. For example, that it is not in America's national interest continue doing to China what it did with the Soviet Union, you know, to have aggressive military patrolling 12 miles off China's shores, because 10 years from now, 20 years from now, you will see aggressive Chinese patrolling 12 miles off California in retaliation against American aggressive patrolling.
Right.
And by the way, you needed to do the kind of aggressive patrolling 30, 40 years ago in the Cold War, because it's very hard to get intelligence. But nowadays, with satellites, you don't need that aggressive naval patrolling.
Right.
So here again is a case of fossilized thinking. Because the U.S. Navy has been doing it consistently, they continue to do it without thinking whether or not it is in America's national interest to have this.
I'm going to switch a little bit to a topic that has again occupied some of the intelligentsia here, and that is, there's a feeling that the president of China, Xi Jinping, has suffered a bit in the last month by two actions that have taken place. One is the World Court ruling in The Hague against claims of the Nine Dash Line, and the second one being the installation by the South Koreans of the anti-missile batteries over very strenuous objections from China. Is that the way it's being viewed in Southeast Asia, that President Xi Jinping has lost two big ones?
Clearly, there has been some diplomatic losses. Certainly, the judgment of the Internal Tribunal of the Law of the Sea, it lost against China, was not positive.
Right.
The deployment of the U.S. anti-missile defenses in South Korea was not positive. But, you know, if you look at it in terms of the overall trend line, the density of China's relations with its neighbors is far greater than America's relations with its countries now. You take even South Korea. China is a much bigger trading partner of South Korea than America is. So you'll find that the economic ties between Korea and China will continue to grow despite this unhappiness over the deployment of the U.S. anti-missile defense.
That's a really valuable perspective. And I'm going to ask you one more. Another point of contention is the rising nuclear capabilities of North Korea. And a lot of people in the United States, policymaking positions, wonder why China does not use its muscle to put a stop to that.
Well, actually, you know, the paradoxically here, and you, I suspect you can ask President George W. Bush this question. The one issue on which the United States is truly grateful to China is that China is actually putting a lid on North Korea's nuclear ambition.
Uh-huh.
It's true that the North Koreans may carry out tests here and there and so on and so forth, but frankly, they haven't developed a nuclear capability yet. And I think the Chinese are as interested as the United States in preventing that from happening. They are putting a lot of pressure on North Korea, but at the same time, they cannot go to the extent of putting pressure on North Korea to the extent that it will collapse. Because the collapse of North Korea is also not in China's interest, because then they'll have a huge problem dealing with refugees and so on and so forth coming from North Korea to China.
Right.
So their difficulty is that they want to put enough pressure on North Korea to get it to behave better, but they will not put so much pressure as to make it to collapse. Private Washington, D.C. is very happy with the amount of pressure that China is putting on North Korea.
We are soon going to have a change in administration. If you were to offer a couple of pieces of advice to both China and the U.S. to improve their relations as we go forward, what might those be?
I think the most important advice I would offer to the United States and China is to remind them that we now live in a shrinking world, and that in the past, when 7 billion people live in 190 separate countries, they were in 193 separate boats, with captains and crews taking care of each boat.
Right.
Today, as a result of a shrinking world, the 7 billion people live in 193 cabins on the same boat. So if the United States and China are in two separate cabins on the same boat, their overarching interest is to keep that boat going, you know.
Yes.
So, for example, the slowdown in the global economy has affected both the United States and China. And actually, there are far greater interest in promoting global economic growth. It's much more real to them than in playing a zero-sum game of naval patrols on each other's shores.
Right.
So they got to figure out where their common interests lie. And you see, that China, unlike the Soviet Union, has decided to grow by integrating itself into the global order. So China is a member of WTO, China is a member of the IMF, China is a member of the World Bank. And so actually there are many areas in which the United States and China share common interests. And they shouldn't forget that as they worry about the zero-sum games on the military side. So if Donald Trump, for example, in the worst-case scenario becomes president, the worst thing he can do is to impose tariffs on China, because the United States will also suffer if there's a trade war with China.
You've been listening to a conversation with Ambassador Kishore Mahbubani for the Foreign Policy Association's podcast series on U.S.-China relations. The music on all these podcasts was performed by the Norwich University Regimental Band, the oldest collegiate regimental band in the country. We invite you to tune in to the next conversation in this series. Until then, this is your host, Sarwar Kashmiri. Thank you for listening.